Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Jeff Gold, member of the philosophy department at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Ariel Gluckrich's book, Sacred Pain, Hurting the Body for the Sake of the Soul. Jeff, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Gluckrich begins the book, trying to motivate the book, by talking about an encounter he has with a friend of his. And I think it's really interesting for understanding the project of the book. Could you describe that encounter and what makes it so important?
Well, he visits his friend by the name, his friend's name is Jacob Gorin, and Gorin lost a limb in World War II in a battle and spent many decades suffering from extreme phantom limb pain. And he spent decades trying every kind of medication possible to eliminate the severe pain without very much success. Well, Gluckrich was visiting him in Israel, and it was around Passover and Easter, and they were watching a documentary on TV. And the documentary showed a, because it was Easter time, a ritual crucifixion in which volunteers were nailed to crosses and lifted high above a crowd of devoted onlookers. His friend Jacob Gorin was so astounded by that, having suffered so much pain for so many years, he said out loud, are they crazy? Are they nuts? Have they lost their minds? Why would anyone voluntarily inflict pain on themselves? Gluckrich took this question really seriously and says repeatedly that his entire book is an attempt to respond to his friend's question. Gluckrich wants to know why millions of religious seekers and pilgrims over thousands of years and dozens of different cultures and religious traditions actually seek pain, why they have a positive attitude toward pain. And the entire book is Gluckrich's attempt to answer that question and present models in which that would try to help us make sense of why people would stand in freezing cold streams and submit to being put on a rack and have nails piercing through their body.
Okay. One of the things that he wants to say is that Gorin, and indeed our entire culture, has a certain view of pain. And it's that view of pain, that understanding of pain, that makes it difficult for us to even fathom why someone might do this to themselves, why someone might have themselves nailed to a cross. What is this cultural model or view that he's talking about?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that that all of us, and Jacob Gorin included, who live in the late 20th, early 21st century in the industrialized world, are products of our conditioning just like anyone else from any other culture. But because we come from this particular world and this particular culture, we have what Gluckrich calls a modern medical model. And in that model, and I think this is important, pain is understood as tissue damage associated with an undesirable and unpleasant sensation. I think of it this way. Gluckrich doesn't put it this way, but I think of it this way, that pain is, under this modern medical model, is like an unwanted house guest, or if we might say a pest. Now, we in our culture pay exterminators millions of dollars to get rid of fleas and roaches and ants. We want to eliminate them, get rid of them. And we would think somebody was crazy if they invited these pests into, I'd like some fleas in my house, or I'd like roaches in my house. Well, similarly, in our bodily house, if we can call it that, pain is seen on the modern medical model as an unwanted, unpleasant guest. And we pay doctors and pharmacies and drug companies millions of dollars to, just like we pay exterminators, to try and help us eliminate that pain. And I think that's the modern medical model, is that pain is an absolutely unwanted guest, and we'll do everything we can to eliminate it and destroy it.
Okay. And as an unwanted guest, it can't really serve any positive purpose.
I think that's the modern medical model, is that you do anything you can to eliminate that, the pain, because it's an unpleasant sensation, and nobody likes unpleasant sensations, or that's what the model suggests. And so we have all sorts of drugs to try and deal with them.
Okay. Now, despite the fact, I mean, it seems to me you're right, the reaction that most of us would have if we saw someone being crucified, voluntarily being crucified, the first inclination is to say, well, that's just nuts. Why would someone do that? Part of what he wants to do in the book, though, is he wants to say that there are, in fact, times and circumstances, or the term he uses, again, as models, under which most of us recognize that there are at least circumstances under which someone might voluntarily seek pain. And then ultimately goes on to try to show how those are related to the more extreme cases that you mentioned. He specifically mentions 8 different models in the book. And I know that you're especially interested in 5 of those that also seem to me to be the most important. I wonder if you could just briefly list what those are, then we could talk a little bit about each of them.
The models that seem interesting to me that I'd like to talk about are the juridical model, the medical model, the athletic model, the magical model, and the psychotropic model. All of those help us to rethink our views about pain. They present models in which pain is not merely an unwanted house guest, but something that you actually might, on those models, you can make sense of why someone would actually seek pain.
Okay, let's talk about each of them. The first one, the juridical model. What does that mean?
For Gluck-Litsch, that means that the idea is that pain is seen as punishment, and it's seen as just punishment and deserved punishment. And he gives a number of examples. The most famous one for those in our culture is the example in Genesis where God tells Eve that she will have to suffer pain in childbirth, presumably as a result of a sin or an infraction. And so the idea is that it's a retributive theory, and it's a just and a moral response to an act of sin or violence or something like that. If you move from the West to the East, in the East they talk about karma, the idea that you reap what you sow. Again, that the idea that the consequences of your act, that you get bad karma or you suffer pain because in some sense you've done something that deserves it. One image of karma that I find interesting is if you throw hot coals at your enemy, you may or may not hit your enemy. You may or may not burn them or hurt your enemy. But the one thing for sure is that you will burn yourself. And similarly, if you commit acts of violence or hatred or jealousy or anything like that, you will burn yourself. You will hurt yourself. Now, so on the juridical model, we suffer. It's a retributive theory. We suffer because, in some sense, we deserve to. Now, what happens is religious seekers take it one step further and inflict punishment on themselves and inflict pain on themselves. And Gluck-Litsch gives a number of reasons, but the two that I'd like to talk about is the first is that by doing that, the first benefit it has by punishing yourself is that it removes guilt. And secondly, because a number of these religious traditions talk about an afterlife, it prevents more serious punishment in an afterlife. And if we go with the juridical model, it strikes me that view is a little bit like plea bargaining. As I understand plea bargaining, if you admit to the crime at the beginning, you might take a smaller punishment rather than be found guilty later on by, let's say, a heavenly tribunal and have to suffer immensely. And so the benefit to yourself of inflicting punishment if you've done something wrong or if you're a sinner is that it removes guilt and it may prevent a much greater punishment later on.
And I wonder, would this sort of be an everyday example of it? I remember when my parents would physically punish me, they would say, well, this is for your good. There was an assumption that somehow the experience of pain for a young child rightly or wrongly, the assumption was that that was going to somehow make me a better person.
I think so. And in fact, Gluck-Litsch quotes the biblical idea of sparing the rod harms the child or spoils the child. So I think that is a good example.
Okay. Now, the second model that you're specifically interested in is also a medical model, though not quite the same as the modern medical model we talked about earlier. What are the circumstances under medical conditions under which people might actually seek pain?
I think surgery is a good example. My father had quadruple bypass surgery in order to save his life and benefit himself, but suffered immense pain, especially in his legs as a result of it, and was willing to endure. So people who voluntarily elect surgical procedures have, in order to eventually be healthier. He talks a little bit in another section about the Greek view and Plato, and I think it actually fits here. Plato's view is that if you commit an injustice, your soul becomes imbalanced or sick or it loses of harmony. And in one of his dialogues, the Gorgias, he has a real famous analogy where he draws a comparison of injustice to medicine. And he says if your body is sick, you go to a doctor. And if your soul is sick or suffers disharmony from committing an injustice, what you want to do is go to a judge. And punishment is actually for the benefit of your soul, because just punishment brings balance and order and harmony to an imbalanced psyche, an imbalanced soul. In fact, Plato goes on to say, I'm not sure if this is humorous or not, that what you should really hope for is that your enemies commit great acts of injustice and then get away with it, that they cheat and they lie and they steal and that nobody ever catches them, because then they will have to continue living with a really imbalanced, disharmonious soul. And again, sort of switching from more Western traditions to more Eastern traditions, in Buddhism, there's the idea of turning poison into medicine. There's a famous story of Atisha, who lived in the 11th century, who at this point, there was no Buddhism in Tibet, and Tibet became interested in Buddhism and invited Atisha to come and bring Buddhism to Tibet. And so Atisha did what a lot of us do when we travel to foreign countries, you know, tried to find out about where he was going. And he heard all these reports that the Tibetan people were earthy and kind and generous and easygoing and friendly. And Atisha got very frightened as a Buddhist and thought that he wouldn't be able to practice anymore. And so he got his Bengali tea boy, who was irascible and nasty and hostile and mean, the kind of person that whatever you say, he would say the opposite, and always insulted people and was just nasty about everything. And Atisha decided that he would have to bring his Bengali tea boy with him to Tibet so he could continue his practice. And again, the idea is that in order to obtain enlightenment, one has to work with suffering and misery and pain, as opposed to avoiding it. I'll just tell you, just because it's interesting, the end of the story is, and the Tibetans love this story, they love to tell this story, because the end of the story is that after Atisha spent some time in Tibet, he decided he needn't have brought his Bengali tea boy.
Okay. All right. In the second half of the show, I want to go ahead and jump to look at the fifth, because I know it's one that you have a great deal of special interest in. I'm speaking today with Jeff Gold from the Department of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Ariel Gluck-Litsch's book, Sacred Pain, Hurting the Body for the Sake of the Soul. The fifth model, again, is one that I know that that you find especially intriguing, perhaps maybe the most intriguing model, because it relates to your interest in mysticism. And that's what he calls the psychotropic model. Maybe first just briefly explain what the psychotropic model is, and then we'll talk about its relationship to mysticism.
In the psychotropic model, in each of the models, he talks about the benefit that there is in seeking pain. So in the athletic model, it's you gain strength by going through difficult training. In the medical model, it's that your soul becomes healthier. In the psychotropic model, which comes closest to mystics who talk about altered states of consciousness, mystics use a variety of techniques to achieve those altered states of consciousness. They use breathing techniques called, in Hinduism, pranayama. They use techniques of meditation. They use sense withdrawal called pratyahara. Let me read to you a quote from Gluklich. He says, anesthesiologists and neurologists know that certain levels of pain possess analgesic qualities and can even induce euphoric states. He gives an example. A low level of nerve irritation or stimulation can mask deeper pain, as anyone knows who has been given a Novocaine shot by a compassionate dentist who shakes the patient's lip as he inserts the needle. And I think the example that we're all familiar with is something called runner's high, where someone might run for miles and miles and miles and miles and for long periods of time, which is quite painful and is difficult to endure. But after a while, something happens and they begin to experience a high or euphoric states. And so extreme training, sitting in like Native Americans do, sitting in a sweat lodge in extreme heat, or standing in a cold river, or sense withdrawal, are techniques used to produce visions and states of euphoria.
How specifically do you see this as tying into the practice of mysticism and his account of how this is related to contemporary neurophysiology?
Well, again, I think I'll read from Gluklich. He has a real interesting passage where he says, inside a sensory deprivation flotation tank, dark, silent water warmed to body temperature and salted to enhance flotation, a bather quickly begins to experience extremely vivid mental images and visions. In contrast, submerged in a cold stream of water, say the Ganges on a January morning, when the skin's surface is assaulted with unpleasant sensory stimulation, the phenomenal field becomes radically simplified and free of mental images. In fact, it becomes reduced to a simple embodiment. And then he goes on to say that an overload of incoming sensory signals, say in the form of ongoing self-inflicted pain, would progressively weaken the body self, resulting in the diffusion of the self or its complete disappearance. This would be a reverse phantom, the disappearance not of sensory or mental images, though these are simplified, but of the subject who experiences of them. In other words, if you're scourge your body repeatedly, the sensory overstimulation would not eradicate your thoughts, sense perceptions, and so forth. But your experience of being a self, an agent who undergoes these perceptions and thoughts, would radically disappear until it seemed that these belong to someone or something else. You would enter a dissociative state, which could be modulated through the pain. For the sake of convenience, the two aspects of the neurosystem may be outlined in the following way, and this is the key. He says that sensory deprivation, like when he was talking about, and that would be mystics sitting in the dark, quietly just meditating, leads to what he calls hallucination or visions or expansion of mental experiences, one things that mystics have traditionally sought, prophets and things like that. And then on the other hand, sensory overload, and this is what really ties in with his book, which comes, or one of the ways it comes is through extreme pain, produces what he calls a reverse hallucination or the shrinkage of mental experience, the weakening of body self. So sensory deprivation or meditation leads to hallucination and vision and inducing pain. Leads to certain biochemical changes in your brain that lead to a dissolution of self. And a lot of mystical traditions have talked about the importance of the dissolution or disintegration of the self or the ego.
Could you give a couple of examples of that?
For example, in the Hasidic Jewish tradition, this is a very theological, God-oriented tradition. It talks about the ego is the main thing that stands between a human being and God, the sense of I. And in the Buddhist tradition, they talk a lot about egocentricity and as something like a cocoon that on the one hand keeps you safe, but on the other hand entraps you and keeps you very, very limited. And we all know that you want to emerge from your cocoon and break free and fly free like a butterfly. And that's kind of the Buddhist image of liberation. So the self imprisoned becomes your prison. And I think what the really interesting point that Gluckich is making is that self-inflicted pain, he's got all these experiments and stuff that have that scientists have studied, begin to lead to a disintegration of the ego, which, as I said, is exactly what a number of these mystical traditions are after. So it would make sense why they would want to inflict pain on themselves, even though they may not exactly put it that way.
And in fact, would this be too strong to say that self-infliction of pain is at least within these religious traditions, perhaps one of the better ways, and maybe in some traditions, the only way in which you can have this dissolution of the self and that's required within the mystical tradition?
Well, certainly after reading Gluckich's book, I take that a lot more seriously. I had always looked at other techniques used that were a little less extreme and a little less painful, quite frankly. But reading all the examples that he gives and the scientific evidence of what it does to this sense of self, it seems like it is a though drastic, a technique that may well lead to this sense of the disintegration of the ego or the self.
In fact, I'm curious, what are some of these other methods that you're talking about that seem less radical?
Some of the things done in meditation practice, which, though, again, could be associated with pain because you sit and you don't move. And if you have an itch, you don't scratch it. And if your leg hurts, you don't move it. So maybe those are, but they're certainly less extreme than hanging yourself by a hook or standing in freezing water while you're naked. Some of those techniques I'm a little more familiar with, and certain breathing techniques and meditative techniques where one actually tries to sort of go beyond the notion of the self are some of the ones I'm thinking of.
Okay. Well, let me ask, though, again, I'm just wondering what Gluckich might say here. I mean, the experience, for example, of sitting in a meditative pose for 3 hours may not seem especially painful for someone who's trained in the mystical traditions, but for someone who's not, to ask them to sit quietly for 3 hours and not do anything might seem incredibly painful. So what he would say is, wait a moment, when you reach a certain kind of religious state, what seemed painful no longer seems painful, that somehow the state that you reach changes your reaction to the painful experience itself, and that maybe the same thing is true of these more radical cases.
Well, yeah, and Gluckich does say that, and I think that's right, that meditators do report that. Well, first of all, beginning meditators usually don't. You sort of train to be able to sit for 3 hours, but frequently do report that the pain is transformed. And Gluckich says that repeatedly, that things that's like piercing your body, that the seekers and pilgrims who've done those things that seem so incredibly painful to people like us and to Jacob Gorin, they actually experience ecstasy and they don't experience. And in fact, he talks about some of the neuroscience involved, that there's something like a gate mechanism that when excruciating pain, things that seem like they would be excruciating pains, what happens is the gate doesn't allow that into the brain at first. And so there's some neurophysiological evidence that, in fact, things that would seem incredibly painful, these pilgrims do not experience the pain as we might expect.
Okay. To that extent, then, the situations or the meditative techniques that you talk about would seem to be at least analogous to the more extreme or radical cases.
I think so, yes.
Okay. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering if now that you've read the book, now that you've thought about it, I mean, you yourself said that maybe you've had to rethink the role that pain might play, even within the mystical tradition. Is that a benefit of this book, an insight of this book, that at least it tries to make us rethink what pain is, why we think of it as so aversive, and what positive benefits it might have for us, at least in some circumstances?
It certainly did for me. It is useful to see the he does a really good job of making sense of why what at first does seem, you know, crazy, the kind of self-inflicted pain people would go through, why if you accept certain views and view the world in a certain way, why someone would actually seek that. So I think he does a good job of making sense of that. Mm-hmm.
Any last points, the last 30 seconds, anything you'd like, perhaps like to leave with the listener?
Perhaps that what's interesting to me is, as someone interested in mysticism, is that he provides a kind of neurophysiological basis whereas mystics talk about altered states of consciousness and have these certain experiential attributes, he's showing how neurophysiology shows how the brain works in those cases, and I find that real fascinating.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking today with Jeff Gold from the Department of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.